I really enjoyed the fact that I could step into a chaotic situation, make sense of it for people, and then step back. I developed an image, my own traumatic suicide, that I would see over and over and over and over again. I really want people to know that it's not your fault. It's not a moral failing. There's an actual reason for depression. In 2014, my wife discovered a new treatment that was being offered locally called transcranial magnetic stimulation. At session number 22, I woke up and I had no suicidal images at all. In your darkest hour, there are things that will work. Treatment does work. I'm living proof.
Welcome to another edition of Respond to Resilience, along with my co-host, Bonnie Rumeli, LCSW, EMT. I'm David Dashinger. On this episode, we'll be speaking with retired fire lieutenant and paramedic Todd Donovan, who's the CEO of Freedom Hill Consulting. And we'll be talking about the Mental Health May Day and many other topics concerning mental health. We invite you to like and subscribe. Our YouTube channel is Respond to Resilience. We're on Facebook, Responder Wellness Inc., and Responder TV, UBSRadio.com, all the podcast platforms, and check out our website, ResponderTV.com, for past episodes and guest information. We will be back to speak with Todd right after this.
In this family, more of us die by our own hands than by the hazards of the job.
In this family, up to a quarter of 911 telecommunicators have symptoms of post-traumatic stress.
In this family, our mental health and wellness are in crisis,
while responders are quietly suffering.
In this family, many struggle with job-related stress,
burnout, trauma, sleep disruptions, substance abuse,
and relationship problems.
In this family, we can help the helpers.
With vital information and resources,
resilience strategies,
and success stories of overcoming the obstacles.
In this family, no one is alone.
Welcome to Respond to Resilience with co-hosts retired Lieutenant David Dashinger, Dr. Stacy Raymond, and Bonnie Rumeli, LCSW, EMTB.
We'd like to welcome Todd Donovan to the show today. He's a retired lieutenant and paramedic with the Derry, New Hampshire Fire Department, and he was with the department for 20 years, but he's been a medic for 30. Todd lives in Chester, New Hampshire with his wife, Nicole, and four great children, who they're now empty nesters. And Todd is a CEO of Freedom Hill Consulting, where he consults with emergency services organizations to manage and strategize their data and to achieve accreditation. We'd like to talk about that further as we get into our conversation. Todd is also the president of the board of directors at the National Alliance on Mental Illness in New Hampshire. That's NAMI. And he holds a bachelor's in business and a master's degree in leadership from Granite State College. Todd, welcome to Respond to Resilience.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Hey, Todd, it's great to see you again. And for our listeners and viewers, I met Todd by accident at the Connecticut Fire EMS Expo back in October. We had a booth right next to each other for 3 days. So we had the pleasure of talking, laughing, eating together. And I quickly grew to see that Todd was part of our family. So I'm really, really happy to have you on today, Todd, and see you again.
I had a great time, you know, spending those 3 days. Those were long days. sitting in a booth, sitting in a booth, you know, is long, but it made it much better than I had good people to talk with. Your entire group was fantastic. I really appreciated the time there. It made the time go by fast.
Thank you. No, we felt the same way. You know, so I wanted to have you on, and I said to David, I would really like to have Todd come on just because you have so many different experiences, I think, that you can share with our audience that's helpful, not just the NAMI piece, but also your career and what led you to the profession. So if you wouldn't mind, we'd love to start off with more of that personal aspect of things. Can you tell us what led you into fire and EMS?
Absolutely. I was 18 years old, and I saw a seizure in my high school, saw someone having a grand mal seizure, and I didn't know what to do. But there was another gentleman in my class, in my English lit class, who was in an EMT class at the same time. And he stepped in and looked confident and knew what he was doing. And I said, that's what I want to do. I want to be that. I want to know what to do. I want to take care of business. And so I went to the volunteer system in Merrimack, New Hampshire, and became what they used to call the pumpkin people, because they would wear these orange vests, and they were the volunteers, and they sent me through a basic EMT class. And that's where I just fell in love with helping people in a time of need. So that's how I got into EMS. And then I went to paramedic school 2 years after that. And I married the cutest girl in the class at of my EMT class. And we've been married for 31 years.
And that's the most important part of the whole thing, right?
Exactly. She was the cutest one in the class, and I got to marry her. So.
Well, plus you know, she must have a better understanding of what you do as a paramedic than a civilian might. Does that come into play in your relationship?
It does. She did not stay with her paramedic as long as I did. She got into medical technology. It served her better in her lifestyle and her thought process better. But she certainly understood, you know, the Christmases, the Thanksgivings, the different holidays that I wouldn't be there, the swaps, the overtime, the sleeplessness, all of that. She understands that much better than most would.
Well, Todd, take us through the arc of your career, 30 years in EMS, 20 years in fire. Where did it take you in terms of mental and physical wellness?
Well, it, interestingly enough, I got into the fire service after really not wanting to be in the fire service at all. But I saw the camaraderie in the fire services that I worked with, and one of my good friends was a firefighter and becoming a lieutenant, and he was talking about the camaraderie that he has with his folks, and I said, you know, that's what I want. I want that. And so I went to the fire academy part time in New Hampshire, and it took me about 18 months to complete all of that. But I did get on into the fire service. I got into one department and then lateraled to the dairy fire department. Mm-hmm. And I spent my entire career there. And I just had an absolute blast, as a firefighter paramedic. I really enjoyed the fact that I could step into a chaotic situation, make sense of it for people, and then step back. Mm-hmm. And allow other people to take the next step in their healing, their recovery, whatever stage that was. So, yeah, it was very, very enjoyable. I had to leave the career 5 years earlier than I wanted to because I had a pars fracture in my L5, in my lumbar spine. And so I had a fusion, and I wound up retiring on a medical disability. But other than that, it was a great career.
How do you think your career impacted your own mental health, if you could look back on it?
Yeah, well, my mental health is actually a pretty interesting story. If you don't mind, I'll get into that.
Please.
When I was 8 years old, I took an overdose of aspirin. I don't remember exactly why I did that, other than I was extremely angry and I knew that I wanted to die. And I never told anybody about that. I didn't tell my parents. I just stayed in my bedroom that whole day and night and let that medicine course through my body. Now, I developed an image of my own suicide, my own traumatic suicide, that I would see over and over and over and over again. It didn't matter what day of the week it was. It didn't matter what day of the year it was, whether it was the best day of the year or the worst day of the year. I had this suicidal image constantly in my mind. And at the age of 14, I was hiking with a good friend of mine, and I was having that suicidal image, and we came across a drop off a cliff, and that's when I heard the voice for the first time. And it was a voice in my right side of my head. It wasn't my voice, but it was a male voice, and it sounded like a drill sergeant that said, "Do it, do it." And when you see your own image of your own suicide over and over and over again, and then you have a voice telling you to do it, I jumped off that cliff. I did have the scars in the back of my head. I fractured a few ribs, but I survived that. But nobody knew that I had done that on purpose. And I'd never let anybody know. And that was in the 80s, mid 80s. No one no one talked about this kind of thing. And so that just went untreated. But when I was 18 years old, I had another attempt that landed me in the hospital. And then eventually I was transferred to a psychiatric facility where I was diagnosed with major depressive disorder with psychotic episodes, because the psychotic episode is the voice that I hear. And so I was prescribed an antipsychotic, which gave me this blink that you see. So it's tardive dyskinesia. And didn't know anything about it back then until a doctor about 10 years ago said, you have tardive dyskinesia because you're blinking all the time. I have to do some things with my lips. I have to blink pretty incessantly. But I'll never forget treating this little old lady in the back of the ambulance. And she said, why are you blinking so much? And I said, oh, don't worry about my blinking. Just let's worry about your chest pain. And so I don't let it bother me anymore. I did take medication for it maybe about 4 or 5 years ago. But it made me so tired that I decided, you know what, the blink and the lip movement and the facial expressions, you know, that's not that big of a deal. I really don't care. And then when between the age of 18, that first hospitalization, and 44 years of age, I've had 6 hospitalizations. I've been on 11 different medications, numerous iterations of those medications. And then I also did in 2008 a trial of electroconvulsive therapy, which did not work for me. In fact, one of the side effects is memory loss, and I lost 3 months of memory from that. And it was a rough ride for me and my wife, to be honest with you. It was really not good. But it works for a lot of people. It just didn't work for me.
Come on. Check it.
In 2014, my wife discovered a new treatment that was being offered locally at a local hospital called transcranial magnetic stimulation, or TMS. And this TMS is an MRI-sized magnet that's placed over the prefrontal cortex, which is on the left side of your brain. And what they do is they look for the motor section. So if you were to take your right hand and place it just behind your ear, your thumb is located right about here. So they place that magnet over the thumb section of your brain on that left side of your brain. They send an impulse in, and they keep moving it around with that impulse being generated until your thumb twitches. Now they know they're in the right area. They move it forward 6 centimeters, and that's your prefrontal cortex. Now your prefrontal cortex is where mood is regulated, and that's where they think depression resides, is in that prefrontal cortex. So you do 36, 19-minute sessions. You can drive yourself to the appointment. There's no anesthesia. It's 19 minutes. And so I went through. I decided I had nothing to lose. I went to that appointment and got my 36 sessions. But at session number 22, I woke up and I had no suicidal images at all. And that was a bizarre experience, a very bizarre experience. I'd never experienced that before. It kind of made me nervous. So I generated those thoughts in my mind on my own. But as soon as I stopped conjuring them up, they went away. And then there was also no voice, which was bizarre too, because I had gotten so used to that voice. And that's the day that I decided that I got remission from depression. It was between session 22 and 23. I finished off those sessions, and then I worked with a psychiatrist to stay on 2 low dose medications, and then I work with a psychologist every other week because I had developed habits that would keep my mood low. And so I needed to learn how to not do that. I had basically learned how not to be depressed. There was a lot of things that I was doing that that would sabotage a good mood. And I had to learn how to undo that. So what I've discovered is if I see my psychologist, I see my psychiatrist, I see my PCP out regularly, and I go to one 19-minute maintenance treatment for TMS every 6 weeks, it keeps me super high functioning. Right. I discovered the fall leaves for the first time. That's what that picture is right there. Mm-hmm. It's just to remind me what that was like. I grew up in New England, and I never saw the fall leaves. I never listened to music as a child, as a teenager. It just never interested me. Music now blows my mind. I can't stop listening to music. I discovered my wife. I discovered my children. I discovered my career. And that's how I got involved with NAMI New Hampshire, the National Alliance on Mental Illness in New Hampshire, is they taught me how to tell my story. And so that's how I got my start telling people my story. And since I've been doing this for the last 6 years, I've been able to talk to about 20,000 people in my count. And it probably would be more, but stupid COVID. And
well, maybe we
can derailed a lot of things.
Maybe this will help put you back on track with that. But your story is really incredible, Todd. And I think for some of the listeners, I'm sure that people have had similar situations and they've never told someone. And so in you sharing something so deeply vulnerable, you open doors for other people and you give them permission to think about or get help for those things too.
Yeah, it's okay not to be okay. That saying, it's absolutely true. I think that, you know, there was a time when we couldn't talk about breast cancer. Now we wear pink, you know, and we couldn't talk about HIV at one point. Now we talk about it. We see commercials about it. We see a lot of different things about it. And so mental health, we're at the ground floor, the basement level of something really big, because mental health affects everybody. You know, for me, I was never traumatized as a child, never abused, never sexually abused. The worst thing that ever really happened to me in my childhood is I got bullied occasionally, but who didn't? And, you know, I my parents never got divorced. They were married for 48 years before they passed away. I have no reason to be depressed. Absolutely no reason. But I didn't realize that I had a chronic illness until I got remission from depression. Then I realized it wasn't my fault. For years, I thought it was my fault. I thought if I just got more organized, if I just become religious, if I go to school, if I buy the house, buy the car, buy the boat, get married to the cutest girl in class, have kids, and then I had four. So you think that I would have learned the lesson with the first one, but I didn't. Having all these stressors didn't make anything better. And I really want people to know that it's not your fault. It's not a moral failing. There's an actual reason for depression. You know, for folks in our field, all of our senses are assaulted on every shift. You know, it's not, you know, you go to a party and people say, what's the worst thing you've seen? Now, for some reason, that word see is used most of the time. But it's for me, it's not necessarily what I've seen, but it's what I've heard, what I've touched. I've touched some pretty unnatural things. It's what I've smelled, and hopefully not what you tasted. That is one of your senses, but that can happen. And then, of course, what you see. So all of your senses are assaulted. And now there are neurons in your brain that are tasked with just memory. And so they are indelibly bruised by the – for me, I don't like – burnt food. It reminds me of other things that have been burnt in my career. I've seen that and smelled it. It reminds me of that. So that neuron in the back of my brain gets triggered when I smell that burnt food. And so that trigger and that memory gets tossed around in your mind. It takes some complex pathways through your brain, and then it eventually goes to the prefrontal cortex. And what is the prefrontal cortex? It's where mood is regulated. So that's where some of your symptoms get expressed, because of that triggered memory goes to the prefrontal cortex, and it can lower your mood. So when you think of a, how many times have you had a bruise on your arm or your thigh, and you just rub it and you rub it and you rub it, and you think that rubbing that, massaging that bruise is going to make it better? Well, we can massage a bruised neuron that tasked with that memory over and over and over again in the privacy of our own mind, and no one would ever know. So it's really important for people to realize that those things that they see, touch, taste, smell, and hear are bruises on the brain. That's the best way to describe it.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. And I would add to that, in my experience, you know, being that a lot of us are empathetic people, performing a job, you know, particularly in these highly charged, dynamic, emotional incidents, that we're, you know, we're sensitive to the energy of the scene too, that we take that with us. And if we don't know how to kind of let it go or, you know, kind of dissolve it, we're carrying that as well. And it's almost like another sense besides the ones you mentioned, Todd. So it's always fascinated me that, you know, we're around some pretty intense energy, and we never really, a lot of times we don't really have a clue how to dissolve it or discharge it. But that's probably a whole different conversation.
That's a fascinating take. I like that.
Yeah. Thank you. I think it comes up, you know, we've had some guests on the show who talk about it from a point of view of Reiki or energy healing, even mindfulness, but it's something that doesn't really get, you know, included in the five senses.
You know, I've been recently having a thought about not only are first responders exposed to inordinate amounts of consistent trauma, right, and really difficult situations, but I think not only do they have difficult childhoods, but a lot of first responders are highly sensitive people, which means all of these senses are heightened, in my opinion, at baseline. And so it makes them incredibly good at their job, but it also heightens the effect of all the things that we're talking about. So
absolutely. It potentiates that bruise.
Yeah. It perpetuates it. And then I think that just to go with your bruise concept, which is, you know, we know that PTSI mimics a traumatic brain injury. That's what it is. So if you do think of it as mini bruises or the one call, that's the baseball bat hit to the head. If we think of those bruises in a first responder, is it that a first responder would rub the bruises more than your average person because they want to fix things and they want to fix everybody and everything? So therefore they try to do it with themselves as well. And it perpetuates.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a good point. I think, you know, I'll never forget a gentleman that, you know, we had went on a SIDS call and he got out and we could hear the mom screaming.
Yeah.
And he took a walk. I just, as a lieutenant, watched my tailboarder just and my paramedic on the engine walk away. And I had to let him have that space for him to absorb that energy. That was a high energy, high impact type of call that we were thrust on. When you can hear the woman screaming over the roar of the engine, the high idle, that's not good. Mm-hmm. It's not good at all. So I really like that energy thought process. I'm going to have to explore that a lot more.
Yeah, I think it's, it's a key thing to, when we have the opportunity to kind of disengage from it, however that is, after a call, whether we're a dispatcher, law enforcement officer, firefighter, paramedic, EMT. I think that's a skill that has to be developed and obviously taught. But again, probably another conversation for another day.
Another conversation.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to kind of back up, Todd, because you talked about, this sort of medical journey you had to, try to solve some of the challenges you were facing. And I think a great takeaway is that you found something that really worked for you and that it was maybe a little bit out of the mainstream. And what other challenges did that create for you in terms of, we all have to kind of go through insurance. We have to, get our medical team on board or kind of get buy-in from our, our family or whoever is kind of helping us through that. What did you experience in that part of your journey?
Yeah. So the, I was actually pretty amazed that my insurance company paid for TMS. Mm-hmm. I was transcranial magnetic stimulation. I was shocked. In fact, I was on the first NeuroStar machine, serial number 0001, in a hospital in New Hampshire. And they paid for TMS. And I was absolutely surprised about it. It wasn't mainstream then. Certainly was. It was very new. It had just been cleared by the FDA in 2012. So it had only been around for 2 years. And now it's everywhere. And people can avail themselves to it. They try to get the word out as much advertising as possible. But it's great for women who are pregnant who can't take medication. It's great for people that have failed medication trials. And it's been a fascinating journey. Interestingly enough, 1 year after I got remission from depression, we were experimenting on what would be the best way for me to stay high functioning. And we came up with every 6 weeks would be the best thing for me to have one maintenance treatment. And after 1 year of doing that, I was I hadn't been hospitalized. I was off a couple of medications. I was just on two medications. My insurance company decided to send me a letter and say, there's no evidence that TMS works, so we're not going to pay for it anymore. So I went 4 months without TMS, and then I said, this is ridiculous. I was suicidal. I checked myself into that same hospital. I spent 9 days there, and my insurance company paid $24,000 for that when TMS was less than the medication Abilify.
Wow.
So it's, we have a broken system. It's not functioning as well as it should.
And that was all the proof you needed to know, this is my magical cocktail of things that works for me, which, as we point out a lot, every single person has their own battery of things that work for them, right? For some people, it's EMDR, Reiki, massage, and acupuncture. For some people, it's nutrition and jujitsu. Whatever those things are, this to me just validates that you found your magical combination that works for you. And I'm so grateful to hear it, to be honest with you, and grateful to hear more about TMS because I personally don't know a lot about it. And thanks to you, I'm going to look more into it myself for clients, because you do have people that medications don't agree with them, or they've tried everything and they're just in a rut. And so I think this is really inspiring, because just as much as we talk about EMDR therapy, it's offering the listeners and the viewers something else they can explore for themselves. And if it speaks to them, they can go and look at it.
I call it a toolbox. My toolbox is different tools than your toolbox. Yeah. A plumber and a carpenter have two different toolboxes. Mm-hmm. My toolbox includes the psychiatrist, the psychologist, the medications, mm-hmm. I realize that I have a chronic problem. It's, when you look at your pancreas tucked in your right upper quadrant behind the liver, it does a couple of things. One of the biggest things we know that it does is that it regulates blood sugar. And, you know, when your blood sugar gets low and you eat that Snickers bar because you're hangry, your blood sugar begins to rise. And then magically, without you even thinking about it, your pancreas and your brain allow that blood sugar to go down by sending out insulin or a hormone or protein into the bloodstream. So your blood sugar drops. And then when your blood sugar drops too much, glycogen from your liver and your large muscles gets excreted and your blood sugar begins to rise. So it does this second to second without you even thinking about it. Now, when we have an issue with our pancreas, we call that diabetes. And there's several types of diabetes. And I think we're getting closer and closer to finding a cure for that. We spent billions of dollars in research. And there's many foundations to help fund that research. But your brain is an organ just like your pancreas. And your pancreas can malfunction. So can your brain. And in my brain, that prefrontal cortex, for whatever reason, doesn't function properly. It creates a suicidal image in my mind. It creates a voice that I hear, and it just wreaked havoc on my life. How I survived those suicide attempts are just phenomenal for me. And I blurted out I was speaking with a bunch of physicians in Concord, New Hampshire, and I blurted out that I didn't want to die. I just wanted the pain to go away. And I thought, wow, that was a revelation that I had never really thought of before, that I actually stuck it out, that I kept trying to find something that worked. And that's what my message is to people, is if in your darkest hour, there are things that will work. Treatment does work. I'm living proof.
When it comes to mental wellness, if I know one of the things that they struggle with is the short staffing, because they're always at work. Working 16 to 20 hour shifts, 4 or 5 days a week, it's real. What are you gonna do when you're in that timeout box? What are you gonna do when you're on the rubber gun squad? You have to go back to who you are as a person. For me, self-awareness starts with knowing who you are, understanding where you've been, understanding where you're going to go, and that's simply what failures have I overcome. The most successful people I've seen is people that say, you know what? I know I'm working this 8 to 16 hour shifts 5 days in a row, 6 days in a row. I'm doing it for a purpose to make myself better.
I was going to say, if you ask us why you survived those attempts, it's because you were meant to be here to do things for you, your family, and the world.
I feel like I'm going to do more in this work than I did as a paramedic.
Hmm. Yeah, it's so interesting. We hear that often, and I think we feel the same way, that kind of after our career on the line, that we have a second chapter where we can be of service and maybe even be more impactful than we were, on the job. So it's a inspiring thing to hear you say that, Todd, and know that you're out there on the front lines, but in a different way. And let's shift gears into that. Talk about the National Alliance on Mental Illness. You're the president of the board of directors in New Hampshire. What do you do? What does the organization do? And kind of what are some of the trending topics going on in that world?
Sure. Yeah. There's NAMI New Hampshire is a great organization. It's a grassroots organization. So it's manned with a lot of volunteers. We have, almost 400 volunteers in New Hampshire in the Granite
wow.
State. And we provide support, education, and advocacy, those three pillars, to people with mental illness and those affected by suicide. And so we do a variety of things to raise awareness in our community. We have a NAMI New Hampshire Walks, which is the largest grassroots organization, a meeting. There's over 2,000 people that do a 5K right in front of the State House in Concord, New Hampshire, wearing their green and walking for loved ones that have died by suicide. It's a pretty impressive organization. And then we do a lot of education. We have several products that we have that allow people to become volunteers and teach these classes. I did what's called Inner Own Voice, which is for people with lived experience. We have another one called Life Interrupted, which is for those who have lost someone to suicide and they can go and talk to those people. Telling your story is the most, storytelling is the most powerful way to get a message across. And so, you know, we really rely on that. And then our third leg is advocacy. We do a lot of work at the state house, at the state level, to really help anybody. We stay in our lane. Which is mental health. And we recognize that there are bills that would affect people with mental health issues, and that goes from gun violence to LGBTQ issues. But we provide a lot of services to the Granite Staters in New Hampshire. Now, I'm just really fortunate that I got onto the board of directors. I really enjoyed it. I think the world of the organization. I think the world of our executive director, Susan Stearns, and the mission that she is putting out there for the staff. And it's just a great organization. And then I became president of the board last year, and I'll be terming off in about 18 months. So I'll go on to another chapter.
Well, congratulations, though. It's incredible to think of your trajectory and how far a person can go in the world to help others with their own story. And, you know, you were talking about some of the different initiatives. I was wondering a little bit, we have an EMDR colleague in Vermont named Sonny Prevetto. He's a retired police officer, but he also started the Vermont Center for Responder Wellness, and they tend to first responders, much like our group in Fairfield County, Connecticut does. I was wondering, are there any similar initiatives in New Hampshire right now that are driven or more first responder specific?
There is the Granite State debriefing team, and we also have the disaster behavioral health response team as part of the state government. But I would say the Granite State debriefing team is extremely active in our area, much like yours is in the Connecticut area. So those are fantastic. We also do at NAMI New Hampshire, we do what's called crisis intervention team training. Mainly for police officers, but it's been a real eye opener for police officers. It's been great to see them, and now it's embedded in the full time and part time police academy at the New Hampshire Police Standards and Training. So it's become a really important. You know, if we're just teaching people about mental health issues after they become police officers and not when they become police officers, we're just chasing our tail. Let's get those people at the beginning of their career and really affect their lives at the beginning so they don't have to struggle and go through the things that perhaps we went through and not being able to talk about our issues. So I think it's been a great turnaround.
That's great.
Yep. So encouraging to hear more and more that this is being introduced at the beginning of a career and a proactive approach rather than a reactive approach. So all great stuff, Todd. We were talking offline and you were describing a little bit about one of your other missions, and that is working with data for organizations to help them with their mission and their strategic planning. Can you tell us a little bit more about what that is, how you do it, and where you do it?
Yeah, I do it. I work out of my home in my office. It's fantastic. You know, I went to London a few months ago and I worked in London. It was just fantastic. But I have 32 individual customers. They go from helicopter services to volunteer fire departments. And I also have several hospitals that contract with me. But I provide data strategy. And that is, you know, how does the sausage get made? You know, how does your sausage look when it comes out in the report? You know, so you hear the old adage, garbage in, garbage out. Well, we try to make sure it's not garbage throughout the whole process. And then we also do data analysis on a subscription basis, where we become your data analyst for your department. For a lot of departments can't afford a data analyst. So we provide that at a low cost. And then finally, we do strategic plans, master plans, accreditation, fire accreditation through CPSE, CFAI, and a variety of things. We've only been in business for 2 years, but if I had known that running your own business and was so much fun, I wouldn't have gotten to become a firefighter. This is great. I mean, I think the other day I took a nap, you know, and
right.
Yeah, it was just great.
I guess
the
that's
boss
the beauty.
Is a real jerk, though.
Right, it's got its perks and it's got its downsides. And
we work hard.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's so great to hear. And I'm curious about the data piece because now we're hearing, departments and even apps are tracking stuff like the calls and the nature of calls to use it in a way that can be kind of predictive or proactive for mental health, and even to document how their members may be using mental health services or even other services. Does that come into play with your what you do?
We haven't done anything like that, but I know there are products, record management products that track your acuity of calls. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I kind of do that similarly, where I create what's called supplemental questions in the FHIR form or their EMS form, their patient care documentation. Was mm-hmm. this a critical stress call? Mm-hmm. And if they check off yes, then their leaders will get an email from that system saying that this crew experienced a traumatic call, so much so that they actually checked off yes. So that needs to be investigated and looked into and help offered. And there's a variety of ways, as David and I talked about, there's many different ways that departments can support their people. I'm sorry, Bonnie.
I was saying that's just so smart. And I was wondering what are you noticing? So the departments that prescribe to that and the supervisors get flagged on these calls, what are you noticing them doing on their side to support that and to create infrastructure for that?
Yeah, one of the things that I offer is I offer SOGs and a variety of different information for departments to develop their own peer-to-peer mm-hmm. System. Mm-hmm. EAPs are great. They're really great. But for the most part, firefighters, police officers, telecommunicators, sheriffs, correctional facilities, they don't really want to speak to someone that doesn't understand their job. They really want to speak to someone that understands their job. And so having a select group of people in your organization that take mental health first aid or different mm-hmm. products that you can take for, you're not a counselor. That's the important thing that you got to understand. You need to know when to hand things off. Most of the time it's a bitch session, and that's great mm-hmm. because you get that energy out, that energy that we were talking about earlier. But you need to be able to know and recognize the signs that something is beyond your capability of helping. Someone talks about suicide or harming themselves or harming others. The gloves come off, and now we really got to get down to brass tacks and get the help that that person needs. That's the one thing that I do for them is I have SOGs and a variety of different resources for departments to create their own peer-to-peer networking project.
Well, all great stuff. As we wrap up, Todd, how can people reach you out there on social media or other ways, like a website? And do you have any engagements or projects coming up you want to share?
Well, I have my website. It's freedomhillconsulting.com. And then you can also find me on LinkedIn and Facebook. Yeah. Get a lot of people that subscribe to me on Facebook and also on LinkedIn. And those are the best ways to get a hold of me. We don't have any big projects coming up. I'm hoping that 24 is a big year for the consulting company. And we are going to do accreditation for one department. It'll be our first accreditation. We're really excited about helping that department out with that. And a lot of fun. It's a good time to be alive.
Well, you're doing great things, Todd. I just really, from the moment I met you, I could tell that you were someone that we needed to be connected to. So I look forward to future conversations. And of course, I look forward to us being together at the expo again.
That sounds great. That sounds really great. I appreciate you, Bonnie. Really,
yeah, you too. Thank you.
Todd, I hope to meet you in person next year at the FHIR EMS Pro Expo. And it was so great to have you on the show. We covered a lot of great stuff today, and I appreciate all you're doing and your being willing to share it with us and our audience today.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate your podcast. I really do. Thank you.
Remember to like and subscribe on YouTube, Responder Resilience. Go to our Facebook page, Responder Wellness Inc. or Responder TV, bbsradio.com, all the podcast platforms, including Apple, Spotify, Google, iHeartRadio, and go to our website, respondertv.com, for past episodes and guest information. Till the next time, stay safe, be kind to yourself. Take care.